Well, it's been far too long. I feel like I say that every time, but we are back with a new episode of the D'Antonio Wingcast. I'm Ben from Blazers Edge. I'm with Kevin Pelton from Basketball Prospectus, and Kevin has been dying to do a podcast for about the last week and a half because the tables have turned on me when it comes to Twitter and a certain important personality who's near and dear to both of us. KP2, do you want to break down exactly what happened here?
Well, I think if you'll recall, one of the lowest moments for me on the D'Antonio Wingcast was about, I don't know, a month and a half ago when we were discussing Twitter and you just casually dropped that Daryl Morey, the GM of the Houston Rockets, the Billy Beane of the NBA, if you will, the vanguard of the statistical revolution, was following you on Twitter, even though he did not follow me on Twitter. And a couple weeks ago, I get the G chat from you, our primary means of conversation, that Daryl has unfollowed you. And then a few days after that, I go and look at my follower list, and bam, right there, at D. Morey has decided that he no longer wants to follow you, and instead he can only follow one person from this Wingcast, apparently, and it's going to be me.
Man, it's so strange that he would go backwards in time like that. Like it's like completing your PhD and then going back and redoing 10th grade. Why would he do this? This makes no sense at all to me. And I don't know what I did to piss him off to get the unfollow. I think I'm pretty funny on Twitter. I guess I tweet a lot, maybe. Maybe he doesn't care about the Blazers.
Well, maybe he just doesn't care about breakdowns of the Greg Oden pictures.
Oh, that's a good point. Well, that was a tough moment for all of us. God, last week sucked dealing with all that fallout. But no, seriously, I'm taking this personally, Daryl. And I'm going to call you Daryl because you once followed me, and I would have been able to direct message you had I been able to work up the confidence to do so. I'm taking it personally, Daryl. I demand a refollow, okay? I understand the follow. I question the unfollow, but I demand the refollow. Is that fair?
We'll have to see whether he can break that strict one member of the D'Antonio Wingcast following at a time rule that he has enacted thus far. But, I think he just knows where the best content on Twitter is, and it's at K Pelton.
Well, maybe he's a closet Washington Huskies fan. He's just like, looking to suffer along with other Husky fans,
Well, he did sign Will Conroy last week, so he's got a certain proclivity for the purple and gold.
Well, there you go. I think we just explained it. I don't think this has anything to do with you at all. I think this has all everything to do with signing backup point guards. I don't think you get any credit. I think if he's looking for a power forward and he wants to sign Shavlik, he's going to refollow me.
Actually, maybe it's he's trying to give Will Conroy crap about every time the Huskies lose, so he's just mining my Twitter feed for material like that.
This has been the most crushing defeat, the most blatant, just turncoat. I mean, it's kind of like a Benedict Arnold, really. I mean, why don't you just block him? Don't you feel dirty knowing that he unfollowed me? Why would you even want him to follow you?
Absolutely not. That makes me like him all the more.
Oh, jeez Louise. Well, anyway, so KP needed to do a little gloating, so we got that out of your system. How do you feel? Do you feel a little better? You feel like you worked out there?
I feel self-satisfied. No other way to put
Well,
it.
speaking of self-satisfying, Greg Oden pictures full frontal on the internet. Man. That was tough. I mean, and I know you don't want to talk about it. You're just going to get into your nervous laughter phase, which everyone predicted when I was telling them about, planning a Wingcast. Here's the only thing I want to say about the Greg Oden situation. Man, was it weird last week to be over at the practice facility, whatever night that broke. I think it was Wednesday when that broke, or maybe it was Tuesday night when it broke. And then 2 days later to be back there, literally 40 feet away from where I was at Greg Oden's press conference to attend Brandon Roy's All-Star press conference. I mean, talk about just the weirdest alternate emotions. It's like you have a guy who's just, I mean, he's rock bottom. Greg is just, you could tell he just really let himself down, let people that he cares about down with those pictures getting out. It was kind of out of his control, obviously, but, KP was not happy. Nate was not happy, and obviously that trickled down to Greg. And besides being embarrassed, I think he felt, a professional obligation to not let that kind of a thing happen. So you have him at this, just low moment. Then 2 days later, 48 hours later, not, 50 feet away from where Greg is having this mea culpa interview with all the local television studios, it's Brandon Roy, who's going about his excellent business, being named to his third consecutive All-Star team, taking it in stride, cracking funny jokes, being as charismatic as possible, and just being the exact opposite of Odin. I gotta tell you, man, that was weird. It was just like from one extreme to the other, just total roller coaster, and it kind of typifies the season for the Blazers.
Well, you know, I didn't read all your coverage of the Brandon Roy press conference, but I was curious. Did the Willamette Week ask if he was, you know, not embarrassed because they'd been hearing that people were impressed by his getting selected to the All-Star team?
Wow. Great one, KB. You're the one who brought up the Willamette Week first and not me. I'm so happy. So here's the thing about the Willamette Week rider and people, I got some emails from people who may or may not be close to the situation there. And just to clarify, you know, what happened with that, the reason why I put up the piece afterwards kind of explaining why people were upset about the whole Willamette Week thing was because people were really upset about it. I mean, I went to the game the very next night, and obviously Odin was the topic of conversation. You know, all the private little conversations before and after the game, everyone's talking about Odin. But a surprising number of people were talking about that question to me and asking me, you know, what I thought of it and expressing some very strong opinions about that question. And so with that said, I felt like I couldn't just let that pass without, you know, putting something out there about that question. Now, I don't know necessarily if it was malicious on purpose, like trying to kind of goad Greg. But the way it was kind of handled in the story that followed it was just kind of flippant and almost like it was a big joke. And it was clear that the person who wrote that is not someone who's been around the team hardly at all. I mean, this is not a joke to Greg. This is not a joke to anyone. I mean, this is a dead serious thing. They were in full spin mode, full damage control. You know, he went from Canzano show to the press conference to courtside, bang, bang, bang. I mean, it was all lined up. You know, it was as methodical and as calculated as spin gets, I think, in the NBA for a sticky situation like this. And the idea that it would be some kind of a joke you can make light of it almost rubbed it in Greg's face, you know, in terms of the embarrassing side of it, because he doesn't want to really think about at that moment all the people who are cracking jokes about him behind his back, you know. I mean, he's got enough of that crap to deal with. And I pointed out, you know, on Twitter, Chris Paul and Carmelo Anthony, two Olympians, two guys that Greg Oden wants to be teammates with on the Olympic team, are making fun of him, you know, kind of using casual terms, you know, insinuating that he might be a homosexual because he put these pictures on the internet. And it's like, you know, that gets back to Greg. Greg's not in a bubble. He hears that stuff. And, you know, his reputation around the league has really been tarnished to a big degree by these pictures. You know, guys are just laughing at him. I mean, he doesn't want to be the butt of jokes. Nobody does. I think he was already a little bit uncomfortable with his body beforehand, and, you know, this is not necessarily going to help that. So I thought that was totally inappropriate. That's why I wrote about it. I think the whole Willamette Week thing is a done deal, but I sure felt bad for him, man. He cuts a sympathetic figure when he wants to.
Well, it stood in contrast to the way that he handled the whole situation, which was with a lot of, I mean, as much dignity as is possible, given what happened, and a lot of maturity, I think, in terms of, you know, stepping up and taking responsibility and not, you know, denying or saying it was photoshopped or anything like that. You know, I felt that maybe holding a press conference was a little bit giving it the story too much credit, maybe, you know, legitimizing it too much, as opposed to just, you know, making a statement, it was me, you know, I regret it, you know, I was young and stupid and something like that. But, you know, I think that he did everything that was asked of him after these photos got out. So I think it was, you know, a positive learning experience for him.
I totally agree. You know, and it was a strange thing that they did to, you know, like you're saying, legitimize the story. But this is the Blazers. They've invested so much time, energy, effort, money, and sweat and tears, really, into the idea that these are good guys, this is a good culture. And something like that for certain members of society kind of questioned the whole culture, you know, and as the organization as a whole, they couldn't be, you know, seen to tolerate that. And it was obviously a situation that Greg created. And I think, you know, he did the right thing by stepping up and owning that situation and, you know, apologizing to everyone in the organization. I thought that was a big move by him. And, you know, I think he's the kind of guy who's getting paid, you know, what, $10 million so far. And he's only played 42 games in his NBA career so far. I think he feels obligated to a certain extent, you know, to justify that contract and obviously to, you know, put himself in the best light for future earnings. And at some point to not address it and not address it directly would have, you know, put him in some jeopardy, I think. You know, I think he had to own this, and he owned it quickly and thoroughly in the right way, and people eventually moved on. So,
yeah, I just don't think he's going to be the last guy. You know, it's the 21st century, and there's so many photos on people's computers that get stolen or things like that. It's going to happen, you know.
So you don't think he's going to be the last guy?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that people take a lesson from it to a certain extent, but it's not like, you know, we haven't seen celebrities' photos get out there in the past, you know, not in the NBA specifically, but, you know.
Well, are you threatening to leak pictures, or you have pictures out there that you think might leak, or what are you saying here? Is this about
I don't
you,
think
or?
You're in any danger of seeing me on the internet anything other than a headshot, but no, I mean, you know, it's privacy doesn't exist for athletes anymore.
Well said, KP2. Well said. All right, let's move on to some happier news. Brandon Roy's All-Star nomination. Well-deserved?
Oh, without question. I mean, he's to the point now where, you know, unless he's injured much of the first half of the season, I think he's basically, you're writing him in at guard for the Western Conference for the next, you know, decade, probably.
Yeah, it was funny how he handled this conference. You know, nobody is better at the photo op than Brandon Roy. You know, I mean, when he signed his contract, he had his kid on his lap, and he's just very shrewd when it comes to that. And at the press conference, he showed up in a Nike sweatsuit, hooded sweatshirt, you know, couldn't be more casual about it, kind of tried to, you know, present the image or the idea that he was just taking it in stride. And, you know, some guys around the league, you know, they get nominated to the All-Star game, they don't really necessarily throw a press conference, but I think in Portland, you know, with it being the only team, and obviously, you know, he's the face of the franchise, they felt the press conference was warranted, but you kind of wonder how many times in the future are they going to continue to do this? Does he get a press conference every single year?
Yeah, I was thinking about that when you mentioned going to those two press conferences, and I was thinking I've been to a lot of press conferences in my life, but I've certainly never been to one about photos on the internet. That definitely never happened, and I don't think I've ever been to an All-Star press conference because, you know, with players that I've covered, it's kind of been something more of a formality. And yeah, I think the fact that it's the Portland market, and then also the fact that the team was out on the road, so there was no way to, you know, get a hold of Brandon on that evening unless he was made specifically available by himself, made sense. But, you know, it's, if he would have, just imagine the outcry if somehow he hadn't been voted the All-Star team, and I think that's what tells you that at this point it's, you know, a foregone conclusion.
Do you know how I knew he was going to be an All-Star?
How?
The only effort they made to promote him was that dinky online video with Travis Outlaw and the little animal that Brandon held and smiled. You know, it's like no iPods, no laptops, no iPads, whatever. It's just one viral video that lasted about 90 seconds, co-starring Travis Outlaw and co-starring an animal. And that was the entirety of the campaign for Brandon. So at that point, I figured, well, they must be pretty confident he's going to make it. They must have tapped their coaching resources and network and realized he was a shoo-in because it was virtually, you know, compared to last year's, virtually no effort to really push for him. And, you know, it showed in the voting tally. Again, he got hardly any votes, but that's what happens, I guess, when you play in Portland.
Well, and, you know, Brandon Roy's never going to have kind of the same personality or interest from fans around the country and outside the country now, as we have so much voting online from international sources, you know, that someone like Kobe Bryant obviously is going to have, but even guys who play for the Rockets and, you know, benefit from playing with Yao Ming and things like that. So, you know, I whether he ever becomes the fan selection as the starter in the All-Star game, I'm not sure, but, you know, I think everyone involved, and certainly the coaches, knows what he's accomplishing, and there's no gimmick required at this point. His game speaks for itself.
No doubt. Well, in his absence, the Blazers have been up and down, and it's been, you know, at times pretty ugly to watch. That 21-2 run at home against Utah to start the game was, what'd you call it, the worst 6 minutes of basketball you've ever seen the Blazers play?
Yeah, I think that'd probably be fair. It was kind of weird because I was doing stats for the Utah radio broadcast with my old friend David Locke, who does their play-by-play. So I was basically getting the gloating Utah end of it as opposed to the frustrated Portland fan end of it.
Hold on a second. This explains the whole Daryl Morey thing. You guys are just a bunch of traitors. You're in a little traitor fan club. You know, he forsakes me to go towards you, and you forsake the Blazers to keep stats for the Jazz? Are you freaking kidding me, KP2?
I'm sorry, but David Locke and I go back long before the Blazers, were part of my life. So, that's Seattle Storm deep. That's how deep it is.
Wow, this is a lot to take in. I feel like you have a whole different family that you're just telling me about, and I'm your son. And like now I realize I have brothers that I didn't know I had, and you've had a secret life this entire time. This is horrible. I'm about to melt down.
I've already told you, we sat next to probably my best friend in the NBA front office who works for the Nuggets, so I got connections around the Northwest Division.
So you're like a plural marriage. You've got
Believe
multiple families crisscrossing the nation. Thanks, KP. Anyway, let's move back on to a topic here. Really disturbing lack of effort to start the game. Do you think that was, in part because Nate just keeps juggling his lineups and guys, you kind of have to get up to start games, you have to know you're going to be a starter, you have to mentally prepare yourself. He's switching centers in and out. He's had these injuries, so some of it hasn't been able to be avoided. But I'm not sure he's got that starting feeling quite down yet within his players. His players don't seem like they're coming out of the gate ready to go. And it wasn't just that game. It's been, 3 or 4 games in a row here.
Yeah, the fact that there was a similar thing, not nearly as drastic, the previous game against New Orleans, kind of, puts that in the spotlight. But I really thought that stretch was much more about how Utah played than how Portland played. It was kind of interesting because it was earlier in the day or the day before that John Hollinger's rankings moved the Jazz up into first place in the league ahead of the expected powers, the Lakers and Cleveland teams like that, based on how well they've been playing since the start of January. And I think that kind of justified it. That's some of the best ball movement and unselfish play that I've seen from anyone this season in that stretch from the Jazz. And it's not like the Blazers are the first team they've done that to, so.
Yeah, they were clicking on all cylinders, and Deron Williams definitely deserved his All-Star berth. I think I wrote that, during one of the first exhibition games, preseason games, he came to Portland and just put on a clinic just like that. And here comes during the regular season, he does the same thing. I mean, that guy's a real stud. He's putting it together. They've got guys healthy. They're really clicking. That's a nice team. That's a team to watch for in the playoffs. Who matches up best against the Jazz? I mean, who is not afraid of the Jazz? The Lakers?
Well, I think the Lakers, certainly match up the best against them. I'd say on the flip side, that Utah is one of the teams that matches up best with the Lakers. We've seen Portland give them a lot of problems at the Rose Garden. Houston is a team that's always played the Lakers tough because of Shane Battier and Kobe. Now, when Utah faces the Lakers, they have the issue that they don't have that real defensive stopper. Andre Kirilenko is a phenomenal defender, but he's not really ideally suited to match up with Kobe. He's more better against kind of the longer, bigger players. But up in the front court, certainly with Mehmet Okur and Carlos Boozer, they can create some problems. And that's a team that gave them some good games 2 years ago in the playoffs when they faced each other in the conference semifinals in what was maybe the toughest series the Lakers had on until they got to the NBA Finals and faced the Celtics. But then last year when the Jazz just had a down season, faced a lot of injuries, things like that, then the Lakers ran through them pretty quickly in the first round.
I'll tell you, after that Jazz game, I was talking to Jerry Sloan a little bit, and dude, that guy's a freaking legend. Do you get the chills when you're in his presence a little bit? I mean, obviously you've been around him, longer than I have. You've got all these connections around the league. You're probably brother-in-laws with him, for all I know. But do you get a little bit of chills when you're in Jerry Sloan's presence? I mean, now that he's a Hall of Famer, it kind of cements that. But he's kind of got an aura about him that is bigger than life, sort of in that Phil Jackson category of opposing coaches where, this isn't necessarily Mike Brown, who may or may not lose his glasses and stumble around the locker room blind, I mean, this is a legitimate Hall of Fame coach who knows exactly what he's talking about, who can break it down in full detail. He's got a little something to him, doesn't he?
Well, I think there's a handful of coaches in that class in terms of Greg Popovich, still belongs there, and I think Larry Brown, certainly given his longevity. Don Nelson is a little bit different, but Sloan and Brown are kind of unique in that they just have such an old school perspective on things. And the game changes around Jerry Sloan, but he's found a way to make his philosophy very successful no matter what else is going on in the league, no matter whether he's got Stockton and Malone or Williams and Boozer and those guys, he's proven it time and again. And And, you know, in terms of talking about people who respect Jerry Sloan, I mean, I think he's sick of talking about it, but certainly no one more than Nate McMillan.
Yeah, no doubt about that. The crazy thing about Jerry Sloan is he's, you know how the coaches have a tendency after the game, they kind of cite the box score kind of off the top of their head. Sometimes they get the numbers right, sometimes they don't. Some guys actually, you know, they'll look down at the box score to check the numbers. I was, like, talking to him about Nick Batum. He's just rattling the numbers off the top of his head without even looking at the box score. I mean, he had memorized it already, you know. I mean, it was just locked into his head. He knew the numbers inside and out, knew his halftime shooting, knew his second half shooting. I mean, it was just remarkable to see. Like, this guy's mind is so locked into what, you know, he's done it so many times, it's just completely second nature, you know. He looks at the box score, memorizes it, you know.
Yeah, he, you know, that statement, you know, that old cliche that he's forgotten more than you'll ever know, I think Jerry Sloan is one of the people that definitely applies to.
Oh, yeah. There's no question about that. It's too bad he doesn't follow you on Twitter. That'd be a real honor.
Yeah, Jerry Sloan on Twitter. I don't see that anytime soon. I'm sure there's a great quote. Someone, I'm sure, has asked him about Twitter, and he's gone, what in the what? What in tarnation?
Yeah, somebody did ask him about Twitter. He had no clue what it was, which is no surprise. He has no need for it. All right, so moving on from the lows of earlier this past week, though, we had a pretty special Saturday night, you know, in terms of how Portland fans will remember it. Andre Miller ties the Blazers, you know, second highest individual game scoring entire franchise history, just two points short of Damon Stoudemire's 54 points. He put up 52, matching Brandon's 52 against the Suns. And he did it almost exclusively on two-point shots, just basically breaking his man down, getting to various spots, throwing the ball up in his herky-jerky way, and knocking it down. I mean, it was kind of a flashback to maybe some street ball from Southern California, maybe some one-man takeover offense at Utah. It was unlike anything I can remember seeing from a Blazer.
So I didn't catch that game. I went to the Seattle University game against Idaho and then to my friend's birthday party. And, you know, I asked my friend who was there who had an iPhone to check out the score. And, you know, he says, oh, they won in overtime, which surprised me, frankly, given, you know, second or back-to-back and the way the Blazers have struggled a little bit lately. And Dallas is a very quality team. But then he looks again at his phone and he just gets a mind-boggled look and hands it to me. And Andre Miller, 52 points? What? I had to immediately send you a text message to try and figure out just what happened because I was so baffled by it.
I'm pretty sure I just sent back like a random string of letters and numbers. I don't think I had any explanation for it. I'm not sure anyone really had an explanation for it other than, you know, he had it going at the end of the game and he just kept going to it. I mean, it wasn't necessarily like he was, you know, not considering other options. I mean, he certainly was. He was still, you know, working the ball around. He only had two assists, so it wasn't like, you know, it was one of his hugest playmaking nights. But then again, there wasn't a lot of guys down the stretch who were making plays, you know, in terms of his teammates. It was pretty much just him. What was amazing about that game was that Dallas never hard-doubled him, really. You know, they never sent Nick Batum's guy at him and just said, you know what, we're forcing the ball out of your hands. And if they did try to, you know, double him, it was ineffective to the point, and he just dribbled right by it, and it wasn't even, you know, it wasn't even anything. And Dallas, you know, their writers after the game were making comments like, you know, this team prides itself on having good defense, and boy, where was it? And, I mean, I'm inclined to agree with that. I don't understand how they couldn't force the ball out of Andre Miller's hand, make him pick his dribble up. You know, they dared him to shoot the mid-range jumper at times, and he hit it, and he hit it, and he hit it, and at some point you're supposed to adjust. They didn't. You know, they tried to put Sean Marion on him at the end of the game, who he's kind of a shell of his former self. That's a different story. But, you know, he was ineffective, and they should have been sending two guys at him the whole time. Nick Batum was barely even looking at the rim on offense. You know, nobody else was stepping up. Blake, his one opportunity, you know, he badly missed a three-pointer when he got the ball. You know, Aldridge has kind of been hit or miss in the fourth quarters of games. Juwan Howard had 0 points until overtime. I mean, I don't understand how you possibly let Andre Miller continue to beat you over and over and over and over again without making some sort of adjustment. It was just kind of mind-boggling. I mean, look at it the other way. If the Blazers had given up 52 points to someone in that manner, everyone would have been going insane saying fire Nate.
Oh, Dwight James' head may explode if that scenario played out.
Oh, yeah, and he wouldn't be the only one. I mean, it would be just, you know, a series of IEDs around the city. But, you know, one thing that I wrote about instead of Andre Miller, which I thought was really nice to see, is that, you know, Nicholas Batum drew defensive responsibility on Dirk down the stretch and consistently play to play. He played him great. I mean, just as good as you could possibly hope for, given, you know, how amazing an offensive weapon is, you know, Dirk is. Would you say Dirk's the best four in the game right now?
I wouldn't say he's the best four in the game. I think that Chris Bosh is ahead of him, and I feel like I'm missing someone. I don't know if we're counting Pau Gasol in there. He's slipped a little bit since his MVP year, to be quite frank. But certainly, in terms of difficult matchups and impossible to guard down the stretch, Dirk is there with anybody in the league. Oh, and it depends if you count Tim Duncan as a four, by the way.
Well, see, honestly, I still think Dirk's got enough in the tank where he's better than Bosh. He's more reliable down the stretch, definitely. He's a tougher mark, you know. He's got more versatility to his game. And, I mean, he's got much better facial hair. No, I'm kidding. But I think you can make a fair argument either way. Him, Duncan, Gasol, Bosh, they're all in that elite four, you know, category. But Dirk and the resurgence of Jason Kidd is what's put the Mavericks, you know, in pseudo-contention in the West, right?
Though I think that they're much deeper this year, you know, with the addition of Marion, even if he's not quite what he used to be. They've got Jason Terry, you know. They've got, I think, better role players, really, than they had last year. Eric Dampier's had his moments. Gooden coming off the bench, you know, even all the way down to Quinn Ross and Tim Thomas as specialists. I think they've put together a better cast altogether than they had last year. But in terms of down the stretch, you know what they're going to, and it's that pick and roll, usually with Jason Terry and Dirk Nowitzki, or they're going to isolate Nowitzki at the top of the key, and he's just going to shoot over someone because he's 6'10", he can jump, and he's got long arms. There's really just no way you can defend that shot, basically. The best you can do is get a hand in his face and contest it and make it as difficult as possible, and I think that's exactly what Nicholas Batum managed to do watching the tape that you put together.
No doubt. And not only was he doing a great job of, you know, people always talk about the contest aspect of it, but that's really what, like, the last third of the defensive responsibilities on a, you know, isolation play like that. I mean, it starts before the catch, botting him, making him work for the spot, you know, expending that extra energy play after play after play to just get the ball where he wants it. It starts with not, you know, losing him on the drive, you know, preventing him being able to go to the basket like he did a little bit earlier in the game. And then the contest comes in. You know what I mean? It's like play after play, he was getting the hand up in Dirk's face and, you know, obscuring Dirk's vision. But it was like this incredible consistency in Batum's ability to just defend him through the entire possession to make his life as difficult as possible from start to finish, even though the end result, which was going to be that turnaround jumper that he loved so much, was almost inevitable.
I would say that the contest, you know, is the product of a lot of that work. So if your footwork is bad and you take a misstep or jab back because of the fact that they jab forward, then you're going to get caught off balance and not be able to get in his face when he rises for that shot. So, you know, I think that kind of, you know, was the product of everything else he did. And, you know, I was stunned watching that tape that Nowitzki wasn't able to take him in the post at all. You know, you would think that with his size and strength that would be Dirk's advantage, but he was happy to get that contested jumper. And I think in a normal situation, he might have made one or two more of those than he did against the Blazers. Those aren't bad shots, per se. I think you said it well, that it's a shot a lot of the time that Dirk is happy with, but also the Blazers coaching staff is happy with because of the fact that, you know, that's the best-case scenario for if Dirk is going to have to take a shot.
It was surprising that they didn't mix it up any more, especially in overtime. They went to, you know, basically almost exclusively on Dirk's possessions, that high pick and roll and the high isolation right there in the middle of the court. But that's obviously, you know, his sweet spot. That's where I guess he wanted to be. And maybe they were just making life easier for him and thinking that he could beat Batum one-on-one on the island, and not having seen a ton of Batum, knowing Batum's really young, knowing Batum's kind of a slight guy. And also Batum was in foul trouble. So maybe they thought they could, you know, get him to foul out of the game if they did that, rather than necessarily putting him into the post. And the Blazers probably would have doubled him if that had happened, just to force the ball out of his hands. But it was interesting to see when Dirk did get into the post in overtime. You know, he took him to the basket that one time, Batum was just all over him, you know, just totally blanketing that spin move pull-up shot that he was looking for, forcing the kick out to Kidd, you know, and Kidd just came up empty. And that's a shot, obviously, that Dallas was happy for Kidd to take because he's been shooting so well. But, man, from start to finish, that was as impressive a stretch of defense. And we've seen some impressive stretches of defense this season. Martell Webster's put together some really nice games. Aldridge has had some nice stretches. But I would say that was the best 10 minutes of defense any individual Blazer has played all season long.
Well, the thing you didn't mention in your post that really stood out to me in watching that was the versatility that Batum has in terms of when they put him on Jason Terry to start the possession, and then were happy to switch that pick and roll when it came with Nowitzki, and then put him on, you know, on the bigger guy. So oftentimes what you'll see is teams, you know, will, in a scenario like that where they know the pick and roll is coming, they'll just invert the matchups. You know, they'll put their big guy on the guard and their guard on the big guy and say, well, you know, you're going to have to not do this pick and roll. So, but then if they go away from it and just try to isolate, then usually they're able to work one of those mismatches without going to the pick and roll. What Batum offers you is he can play either of those matchups almost equally well, at least in that scenario. So, you know, the Mavericks weren't thinking, okay, we've got Batum on Jason Terry, let's just clear out and let Terry go one-on-one, because that's not going to work. You know, and that's what really Batum's ability to defend big or smaller players is going to give you in terms of, and then also I think LaMarcus Aldridge deserves some credit in that he can stay with a guy like Jason Terry on the perimeter when you make that switch.
No doubt, and it seemed like a pretty confident or focused decision to change how they played it from Nate McMillan. After they got burned on that one switch where Batum tried to fight through, Aldridge didn't see him fighting through and they ended up leaving Dirk. It seemed like from that moment on, they just decided we're going to switch everything that involves Dirk, and then we're going to consciously try to make it so that, you know, when we do switch, it's Batum who winds up on Dirk. That seemed to be a pretty conscious effort. And like you're saying, you know, they kind of inverted that matchup, you know, with the idea that, you know, he could handle Terry, but if there was that pick and roll that they kept going to over and over and over down the stretch, then Batum would end up on Dirk to contest the one-on-one. And he was obviously more nimble and able to, you know, contest and avoid the foul a little bit better than maybe Aldridge was. Aldridge at one point, memorably, I didn't put this in the tape, but memorably, you know, kind of a major play that people were harping on him for is he kind of poked Dirk in the face. He fell for one of Dirk's little pump fakes and put Dirk on the free throw line for some, you know, freebies. So I thought all in all it was a great scheme by McMillan. First of all, I didn't mention this, but he saved Batum for Dirk until crunch time. So he never kind of tipped his hand or showed his hand, you know, that Batum would be able to guard Dirk until the very end, and then he whipped it out right, you know, at the time it would be most confusing for the Mavericks. And then he also, you know, switched him down to some of the guards a little bit more at the end, including Terry, with really good results. I mean, Batum laterally, his quickness is just next level.
And I think that really Nate McMillan's defense thrives with those kind of guys on the floor. If you look at the, you know, where kind of a lot of his defensive philosophy is predicated, it's his playing days with the Sonics and George Karl. Actually, it goes back before George Karl, I should say. It's Bob Kloppenberg was an assistant coach at the time who invented the SOS pressure defense. Is what he called it, that called for a lot of trapping, a lot of switching, and that's what really made the Sonics defense so difficult in the 90s is that because of the way they played, you know, often with Sam Perkins as an undersized center, you had Sean Kemp as a very athletic power forward, Detlef Schrempf, a 6'10" small forward who can handle all sorts of different matchups. Either Gary Payton or Nate at the point guard or in the backcourt is big guards who aren't overmatched when they're switching against size on the post. So they switch to basically every pick. And I think that sometimes, you know, Nate has been guilty of over-switching with his own defenses with personnel that is not quite suited for that style of defense. You know, that was especially, I think, true towards the middle of his run as the head coach here in Seattle. He's probably become more flexible, I think, with it down in Portland. But that's one thing that does pop up is something that he doesn't do well as a coach. But when you've got a guy like Batum and when you've got a LaMarcus Aldridge who has long arms, moves his feet relatively well for a 6'11 guy and does a very good job, in my opinion, when switched out onto a smaller player, you get the flexibility to do that sort of thing. And I think that really takes his defense, you know, up a notch.
If you're totally on the money with that. I mean, we even saw some of the downfalls of over-switching when Oden or Prisbilla was in there. And, you know, Nate actually talked about at the beginning of this season to look to cut that down when the center was involved with the pick and rolls. In other words, you know, the guards were going to need to fight through more picks if the center's the center's man was setting the pick, as opposed to if Aldridge's man, you know, Aldridge is playing four, his man sets the pick, then Aldridge would, you know, be more apt to switch. He was looking to find, you know, certain situations where they would expect the guards to fight through the pick. And by and large, the Blazer guards have not shown a huge capacity to be able to fight through picks. I think most people would agree with that. And that's what Batum brings, is not only the flexibility to switch, but also a certain tenacity to fight through picks that maybe other guys, you know, haven't displayed so far. So I think it definitely opens up Nate's possibilities. I think Nate's like a kid in the candy store right now with Batum, thinking about all the different ways he can use him. And it's amazing that a guy who's almost like your prototypical three almost does a better job guarding fours and ones than he does even guarding a normal three. I mean, it's just, he's just such a freak versatility-wise that his length, his quickness just causes problems for guys who are either shorter or, you know, in some cases, bigger and used to being able to shoot over guys with no problem. I don't know. He's just an incredibly fun player to watch. I would say his ceiling right now, defensive player of the year.
Yeah, I mean, that's a bold statement, but I don't think it's unreasonable. And, you know, he's just he's a different look than those guys are used to. You know, someone like Kobe Bryant or even Kevin Durant is fairly used to playing a player like Nicholas Batum. I mean, not that there's a ton of them, but that's their general matchup, whereas when you get him on a point guard or even on a power forward, it's taking them a little bit out of their comfort zone.
Well, here's the next question, and we kind of been debating this around for a while, is how long does Nate wait to put him back into the starting lineup? I mean, you got to do this pretty much immediately, right? How can you wait? When you see a guy who can do this at the end of a game, why do you even mess around with him coming off the bench? Just make the call, right? I mean, obviously you don't want to sacrifice Martell's good progress, but forget about it, you know? I mean, if you need to, move Martell down to two for a little while and get Bayless out of the starting lineup. But you can't submarine yourself by having arguably your best defender coming off the bench. Get him in there.
I don't know. I'm not a huge starting lineup guy. To me, you know, as long as Batum's getting those minutes, whether it's coming off the bench where also you can kind of spot him to bring him in, you know, at various different positions and take advantage of that versatility we're discussing, you know, that's one thing you can do with him, I think, off the bench. So to me, it's not a big urgent thing, and especially if you feel like, you know, Webster is going to suffer a great deal if he's not starting.
Well, I think Batum is the kind of player you need to get playing 40 minutes ASAP, you know? He's just not a liability in any way. He does enough. He gives you so many extra possessions on the defensive end that it makes up, even if he scores 0 points, it makes up for it, you know? It's even better than he was last year. And last year he was, you know, playing much less minutes, but he has the potential to be, you know, a 40-minute a night guy. Maybe not on this team because, you know, they're so deep at that position, but, man – it's hard to watch him when he's not on the – I mean, during that during the weekend game against Houston and against Dallas, you know, until Andre Miller really started heating up, I was getting to the point where, like, I only wanted to watch Batum's minutes. I didn't even want to watch anyone else's minutes. It was like, if he's not in there, I'm angry. Maybe that's completely irrational, but that's kind of how I was feeling. It was like, get this guy in the game. And then to get that paid off so well by his stretch down, you know, down his play down the stretch against Dirk. Oh, that was a satisfying feeling for someone who's, you know, quickly jumping on and jumping over, I guess, the Nick Batum bandwagon.
You know how Bill Simmons writes about how Blazers fans are like the parents, and, you know, they're so supportive of their kid, and they think he can't do no wrong? That totally is you with Nicholas Batum, for the record.
Oh, definitely. I don't disagree with that at all. I mean, if they want to call us a cult like Nate McMillan did, they want to call us overprotective soccer moms, I mean, what can you say? I mean, you read the story I wrote about this guy. What night was that? Wednesday night against Utah when he banged on Kyle Korver's head? I mean, he's demonstrating to me how a protective sleeve was preventing him from overcocking his arm and dunking too hard on a player's head, thereby potentially saving him from an injury. Because he knew in his own mind, and he was willing to admit to a reporter in his own mind, that he could not control his ability to dunk too hard on people's heads. And it was good that he had the sleeve to hold him back. I mean, how do you not love a guy like that, you know? It's like, if you're not on this bandwagon, if you can't see what this guy's potential is, it's like, I don't get it. Like, why would you ever bury someone like this on the bench? It just drives me crazy. And I guess maybe part of it is Nate's worried about the shoulder. And I think that's the one reasonable excuse. But let's say this. If Brandon comes back, let's say, you know, before the All-Star break, don't you just casually move Martell back to the bench and bring Batum back in with Brandon and just say, okay, here's our best five?
I mean, I wonder also if one way to get from here to there is possibly to move Batum into the starting lineup right now in favor of Bayless and put Webster at the two where he's been playing, getting a little bit more action, you know, and then when Roy comes back, it's for Webster as opposed to, you know, moving Webster out specifically for Batum. It's just kind of done more gradually.
I would be fine with that too. I mean, so much of this hinges on Brandon's evaluation, which I guess is taking place probably as we're speaking right now. So news probably should come out of that relatively soon. He sounded optimistic that he'd be able to go to the All-Star game. So let's just assume, you know, he probably does come back before the All-Star break. You know, I would say by the time Brandon gets back, Nick should be right alongside him because Nick is only going to play better when he's playing alongside Brandon, you know? I mean, he only becomes that much more valuable when he's playing alongside Brandon. I don't know. I just think as soon as Brandon's back, Nick's got to be in the starting lineup. End of discussion. Unless there's some serious concern about his shoulder that, you know, we're not aware of, which is possible because he's obviously still wearing a sleeve. But
and Brandon
anyway.
Has been driving the Nick Batum bandwagon long before either you or I were on there. And I will note for the record that who did the OregonLive.com I forget the name of the series at the end of the year where I had to write up about the player who did Nick Batum last year. It wasn't Ben.
Well, that's true. But, hey, if we're going to play this game, and people have been trying to accuse me of this jumping on the bandwagon thing, let me say that I was the first person to interview Nicholas Batum at Summer League 2 summers ago under the post title Mr. Adorable. Okay? This is so early in his career. He didn't even speak English. Okay, so I conducted an interview entirely of head nods, questions, smiles, half smiles, and, you know, nervous, uncomfortable energy. So you may have gotten on for the UB of the Gym bandwagon, okay, but I was there back before he was still French.
I'm surprised that you didn't title it Monsieur Adorable.
Or Adorable. All right, we should probably end it there. But you'll be the happy uncle for Nick Batum, right? If
okay.
I'm the soccer mom, you can be the happy uncle.
Okay, I think that's fair. Just as long as I don't bring his other brothers who are Jazz and Nuggets fans, or your other brothers who are Jazz and Nuggets fans around, I guess.
Exactly, they're not welcome at this party. Well, unless they want to get dunked on. All right, we'll leave it there, just like Kyle Korver, just like your buddy Kyle Korver. Have a good week, KP2. Are you coming down for any Blazers game this week?
You know, I don't know if I'm going to try and go to the Lakers game because the Huskies are playing opposite that. And, you know, any time they play at home and actually have a chance to win, I think I need to watch that.
Well, who are they playing? East Idaho?
Stanford and Cal. The Pac-10 hasn't gotten that desperate quite yet.
All right, just checking. You said they had a chance to win, so I figured it was someone crappy. All right, we'll leave it there. Take it easy, KP2. Have a good week.
All right, you too, Ben. Unhook me up with all this cheddar and loot. The best rap deal of all time, next to Snoop. Money more to clutch, money more to touch. I don't just rhyme, I own liquor stores and such. But yeah, yo, the rap game remind me of the crack game. Niggas wanna get their gun, then start the clap game. For that fame, grow entertainment. Sports, drugs, entertainment. Ta-da.